Are you a questioner, a wanderer, or even a bit of a snooper? If so, then you'll feel right at home in Knoxville. We've got miles of trails to wander in our urban wilderness, award-winning eateries to satisfy your culinary cravings, cultural sites to open your mind, and dog-friendly activities that'll have everyone wagging. Knoxville, calling the curious. Learn more at visitknoxville.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. It's great to have you with us. Today, we have Kevin Cook with us. He is the author of the new book, The Tiger Slam, The Inside Story of the Greatest Golf Ever Played. And as you can imagine, that is about Tiger Woods' incredible run in the majors from 2000 to 2001. Kevin, thanks for being with us. With this being the 25th anniversary upcoming of the start of the Tiger Slam, is that what prompted you to get into this topic of Woods' incredible achievement?
Well, it's good to be with you, Ryan. That is right. I was surprised to think it's 25 years. It still seems pretty vivid to me. 25 years coming up, and the more I worked on the Tiger Slam, the more I came to think that this truly was the best that golf has ever been played before or since his dominance at that time. And I actually think it's up there with DiMaggio and any number of other great sports feats. And in my opinion, it's a little bit underappreciated.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I know we talked a little bit before doing the interview again over text, and that I couldn't agree more that it feels like 25 years later, it still isn't appreciated. And maybe even it wasn't at the time, because even Jim Nantz had to come up with the Tigers, you know, his own term, as grand as it gets, to describe it, because if people would put it down for not having happened in a single 12-month period of calendar year, that to me still seems criminally insane that happened in the first place.
I think that's true. And there was a lot of talk at the time, oh, does it count as a Grand Slam? Earl Woods himself at the time said, well, I'm a purist. I think it has to be in a calendar year, before he changed his mind a little later. And as Tiger said, if I've got them all on my coffee table, that's a Grand Slam to me. And I do believe, I think you're right, that it ought to be more remembered as one of the most remarkable things that ever happened in sports. I don't think we're going to see anybody win four majors in a row again. I don't think we will ever see anyone win a U.S. Open by 15 shots. The things that he did at that time, he was so far out ahead. And I remember thinking in the late 90s, well, Jack Nicklaus has raised the professional game and given other players time to kind of catch up and narrow the gap on him. We probably won't see a level of dominance like Nicklaus at his best. Next thing you know, there is a performance that, in my opinion, blows away Nicklaus at his best. Nicklaus himself said, I didn't ever play that well. Jack certainly has the most majors and longevity in his favor. But when you really boil it down to when was golf played the best it's ever been played, I think it was the Tiger Slam.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that in the historical debate that exists and will continue to exist for probably as long as we're alive and longer of Jack versus Tiger, I think that's the distinction of Jack was prolific. He figured out how to win in almost every tight situation you can imagine, which unto itself is an incredible skill. But Tiger was the most dominant champion in volume that golf has ever had. Does that seem like where we've settled on this now?
Yes, and I think he also brought so many new things. I mean, fitness, certainly, before Tiger. Now, Jack was fit, but, I remember pro golfers whose idea of exercise was doing wrist curls with a tumbler of scotch. That was basically it at the 19th hole. Tiger was the fittest. He was the most determined. He had the best psyche. He had the best swing. He was brave enough to take the swing that won the Masters in 97 by 12 shots and remake it, because he didn't believe that he was going to win as many majors as he wanted to with that swing. It was risky. It was brave. He brought an engineering approach to his swing. And I think one of the pleasures of working on the Tiger Slam was that all this stuff happened before there was any scandal, any car crashes, even the terrible injuries that he suffered later. This is a pure enjoyment, I think, of golf played at an amazing level.
We kind of enter into, this is a good transition to where we enter kind of the story into 2000. You know, he wins the PGA in 99, it's almost this sense of relief that, hey, maybe this is starting to pay off what I'm working on
Right.
with Butch. But, 2000 Masters comes and goes. I don't know if there was an expectation he was going to necessarily keep on winning majors after the 99 PGA, but he comes in with two majors, and we get to the US Open at Pebble, and Pebble has now taken on a little bit more significance, I think, as a US Open venue because they want to come back there regularly. But at
Right.
the time, it kind of felt like a special year. We're going to get Pebble, we're going to get the Gold Course. Valhalla is what it is, but we're going to get those two places in
Yeah.
one calendar year. And what was the what you found going back looking at it, where was the golf community thinking Woods was going to land come Pebble Beach? I mean, was it, all right, he's going to win, he's clearly the best player? Was it Phil, Tiger, Ernie kind of thing, a big three that we tried to make the big three, big four, big five over the years? Where was golf expectations with
I
Tiger?
think the expectation was that he was certainly the favorite, but not the kind of favorite that you can take him or take the field. That's coming very soon, after his dominance, after he showed on these little bumpy greens at Pebble, a level of putting. He didn't miss out 10, anything under 10 feet in the entire tournament.
On POA.
And it is the 100th US Open. It was a fitting venue. This does turn out to be a remarkable slam in which you've got three of the world's five or six best courses, certainly the most famous iconic courses, and a pretty good one, where it turns out there's going to be the most dramatic of them all at Valhalla a little later in the slam. But Pebble certainly put the world on notice. Here's the only player under par. Second place is two, three over, and he could have 15 putted the last green and still tied, still made a playoff. That kind of thing isn't supposed to happen, especially in a U.S. Open. And before that open, remember, it was often said, well, Tiger's, the U.S. Open doesn't suit him. He's not a straight enough driver. He addressed that, of course, himself, and completely blows away the field with a couple of moments of high comedy when they almost ran out of the brand new golf balls. And he daringly comes down at the end. I admired his approach because he was so far ahead. The tournament was not in doubt. On Sunday, he decided, I'm not going to, he set a new goal for himself. I'm not making a bogey today. He almost bogeys 18 that day, and his one of his last thoughts before winning the Open by 15 shots was, I'm really going to be furious if I make six on the last hole, and it's going to besmirch my whole day. That's the kind of approach, the mental approach he brought.
I want to get to this because otherwise I will probably forget. But you brought it up, the Steve Williams anecdote, and Tiger's talked about it later, about almost running out of solid core golf balls, which I think after the fact, a lot of people have kind of retrofitted into the story as being an important thing, having used the solid core golf ball a little bit ahead of his peers. Do you find that to be the case? Do you find that in anyone else's other estimation, maybe either Stevie's or Tiger's, that was a very significant part of this major at Pebble, but then subsequent parts of the slam?
Steve Williams later said he thought it was important. He thought it was worth a couple of shots around, which I don't believe. Butch Harmon told me he does not believe that the ball was a big factor. At the same time, Butch is mostly about the swing. I think it was a factor, and it's more proof of Tiger's courage at that time and the engineering approach he took to the game. He's playing with O'Meara, and O'Meara's playing a strata, and O'Meara's ball is performing around, pitch shots, chip shots, like it's on a string. And Tiger says one day, how do you make the ball do that? And O'Meara lays it on pretty thick, says, T, it's just the kind of thing that takes maturity. It takes a veteran to understand what I'm doing here. And Tiger tried one of those, and oh, it wasn't you, it was the ball. He goes and works with Bridgestone. It was a Nike ball with the swoosh on it, made by Bridgestone, to develop prototypes of the ball that's going to be the Nike Tour Accuracy. It gave him an edge. You certainly don't want to give Tiger Woods an edge going into the 2000 US Open, but he did have that. Of course, the whole world of golf equipment is about to change with the Pro V1, which is going to attempt to catch up and did catch up and more with Tiger's ball. I think the ball mattered. It certainly wasn't the reason he won, but It also adds to his confidence. He's got something in his pocket that nobody else has that he's developed himself. O'Meara had told him before any of that happened, they'll make a ball just for you. And that's what they did.
Do you think he would have been as apt to make that change in golf ball were he not at the point in his development with the new swing with Butch being successful and having proven some major success with it?
I do think he was willing to let's complete this thing.
Okay.
Let's make every facet of the game as good as it can possibly be. O'Meara's playing the strata got him interested, and as soon as he started hitting this ball, and you hit a ball into the wind, and your old Balata ball full of wound up rubber bands moves 15 yards, and then you hit a prototype and it moves 7 or 8, that's going to get your attention.
Yeah, for sure. So we've got he wins the US Open by 15, which is still unfathomable. Do you think the shock in all of that may have had a hand in people diminishing it to a degree? And I this is a kind of strange idea of putting it, but then he won by so much, and people were used to Nicklaus winning majors by one and two and three in a playoff. They were tight contests that almost diminished it because he was that much better than everybody else.
It's a good point because it almost did go by, oh, he made it look easy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, he looked like he was playing a different game from everybody else. It should have put the world, I think, on notice that something remarkable is happening here. At the same time, it wasn't all that dramatic on Sunday. Here he marches to victory, and it's one of the most remarkable victories that ever happened, but it's not as dramatic as coming down the back nine on Sunday in a battle, and as Jack often would do. Jack had pebbled himself, hitting a one iron off
Yeah.
the flag at 17. Doesn't get more dramatic and memorable than that. I think it did cost Tiger a little bit in terms of the appreciation of what he was doing.
And it's a strange thing to me that that would be the case because I mean I remember him tapping in the final putt and the kind of arm raise, but there was no I guess the golf fan doesn't think of it as a dramatic victory. They just think of it as he killed everybody and on to the next thing, instead of appreciating that for what it was, that there was literally no drama on the last 10 holes. I mean, he could have done
Right.
anything he wanted. He could have teed off with 7 iron and still won the US Open.
And it's so telling that he invented a challenge for himself.
Yeah.
He's only going to be happy if he plays a bogey free round on Sunday, because that's what kept him invested to the greatest possible degree. And I firmly believe that whatever anybody thinks about Tiger Woods personally, that when he was on the course, nobody was ever a greater grinder than he was. That's certainly one thing that he had in common with Nicklaus, but I think Tiger took it again to a whole new level. Nobody tried harder on every shot to save every shot than he did.
I was going to bring that up, and I think you kind of completed. So I want to continue that line of thought that Tiger's dominance didn't come with flippantly. I mean, he had to set goals for himself throughout each stage of the process. Like you said, have a bogey-free Sunday, try to shoot a certain number on a Saturday or Sunday, even though you probably knew the thing was in hand. He figured out ways to create his own extra challenges, almost extra credit, to make sure that he stayed in the game. But was that because he thought he would maybe lose concentration of the broader picture? Or was there some other reason for those mini games?
I think to a degree that's true, that he doesn't want to lose concentration because that might lead him to shoot one shot more than he would have if he were absolutely on all cylinders at all times. And that's what he wanted to do. To the degree that as Butch Harmon told me, this is after this particular US Open, he's going to be hitting what Butch called inappropriate shots, shots that are not made for the course that he's playing in Illinois, because he's thinking of Scotland and playing, hitting some low stingers and hitting some balls to see how far they roll out, because he had to practice them in competition. It's not good enough to do it in the range because your juices aren't flowing the same way when you're not in competition. That's another way he was so attuned to his game and his psyche. It's hard to imagine anybody could have kept up with him at that time.
That brings up something I wanted to touch on as well, because of what we talked about earlier. We've got Pebble, we have obviously Augusta, Pebble, the old course. And again, nothing against Valhalla. It turns out to be the most interesting one. But Tiger being an architecture aficionado, a history aficionado, with how far ahead was he thinking? When did it dawn on him? 2000 is not only a big round number, but it's got these incredible venues in the Battery for the majors.
He often said that the two places he loved to play as much as any were Pebble and well, three, Pebble and the Old Course, and of course Augusta, which was people used to say was made for him before they quote unquote tried to Tiger proof it. He was playing a PGA Tour event and finishing 23rd because he was getting ready for the Old Course. And another thing that he did, he's transforming his game entirely before he goes to Scotland to play links golf, which I think like Bobby Jones, like Sam Snead, like any number of other players, when they first see the Old Course, you think, where's the golf course? This is just an entirely different kind of game. It's played along the ground. You have to be completely creative with the contours. And he wound up, like Jones, really taking to that and enjoying it. You're not going to play target golf and hit up. The wind is howling like crazy. You're not going to hit a sand wedge when you could bump and run a shot. He plays a completely different game, suited to the conditions, suited to the course. Wins by eight at the. Old course, heartbreak for David Duval, whom Tiger saw as really the biggest threat to him to win majors in that time. Duval's fighting his back, but had a wonderful tournament before he had a nightmare at the Road Hole, which is going to get you at some point.
And there are a couple of different astounding things about that open at the Old Course. One, he managed to avoid bunkers. I mean, that was the game plan, was to find a way to play the golf course to avoid bunkering and then almost score from the green back instead of tee to green. And that he accomplished it was even more stunning to me because we've seen the Open plenty of times at the Old Course, seen the Old Course played every year in the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship. Avoiding those bunkers, that for 72 holes, that to me was that was I know yeah he won by eight, and that's great, but that he the manner in which he did it so surgically and then reached a depth of under par in a major we had not yet seen yet, that both those things together.
It's a sort of perfection. If you set out to do, okay, what you have to do to win the Open at St. Andrews is don't hit it in any of the bunkers. Okay, zero. How about that? You're not going to be able to top that. This is what I tried to do. And of course, those of us who've had the pleasure of playing there, it doesn't even come across quite on television how much a pot bunker is like a manhole. You're just going to be lucky to, and you take your medicine, get the ball out of there. But the best thing to do is not to hit it in there in the first place. He spent a great deal of time with Steve Williams just trying to see how far the ball is going to roll out. Because the ball may roll 115 yards into a bunker that you didn't think that it was going to reach. It may take a crazy hop and go in there. And again, as you say, and he didn't just barely miss a lot of bunkers. It was such a consummate show of strategy following this dominance at Pebble, that I think the golf world was truly on notice that something amazing is underway here. And then there's starting to be talk of, oh, suppose he wins the next two in a row, is that going to be a slam?
Right, and that's where the talk really starts to pick up when Tiger doubles his major tally, goes from two to four in the space of what, 4 weeks, not even. And all of a sudden, it also felt like that maybe that open was the turning point of, okay, maybe this guy really is special because you've got four, you're 24 years old. You can do the projections. You can start to think of if no one's going to catch him, he's winning by 15 and eight. How long can he do that? And
That's
then we
true.
get to the PGA, which turns out to be the most interesting and close of them all. And it's the first major he really has to win. I mean, Sergio gave him a thread at Medina, but the first major he's really got to win with everything on the line and someone just running him down.
And it's such great drama that the man who was running him down and giving him all he wanted, turning it into Ollie and Frazier down the stretch at Valhalla, is Bob May, a junior phenom from Southern California. The Tiger and Phil were trying to break his records. Bob May is one of those people. In a way, it reminds me of the great Little League players. You know, the players who dominate Little League are usually the ones who are the biggest at their age, 12 years old. And May was, Tiger was literally looking up to Bob May when May is a junior player and Tiger's 7 years old. But May stopped. May didn't get nearly as tall. He's not my height, and I'm only 5'8". But he had a very steep approach. He was a great ball striker, a student of Eddie Marin, swing the handle, and had been playing very well. It wasn't just a fluke that Bob May was competitive. He's going to shoot 66, 66, 66 at Valhalla. The venue, I believe, especially in early rounds, did let a lot of people who aren't at that time the ultra elite of the PGA Tour stay in contention. That makes it interesting too. But the guy who stepped up and gave Tiger all he wanted when Tiger is playing at his zenith is Bob May, who trundled in a putt on the last day to send it into a playoff, forcing Tiger to make one or he loses. And that is the moment that Tiger later said, "Well, I'm Tiger Woods. I'm supposed to make that putt. It's a downhill 6-footer." Well, a lot of people don't make it.
And I realize the gravity of that 72nd hole putt in 2008 at Torrey Pines is the one people are going to remember more.
Yes.
But the 1 of 18 at Valhalla in 2000 was no joke. And that was one he could have easily missed. And Bob May could have been the PGA champion. I think people underappreciate that.
That's true. And Bob May is sitting there thinking, don't expect him to miss it. And you don't. You must expect him to make it because you've got to be ready to go to a playoff. But it does cross one's mind. And May said, yes, it did cross his mind. If he misses that, I'm the PGA champion. It sure got dramatic in the playoff. There's a ball that goes, Tiger hits so wildly that it goes out of camera range. It's conceivable. No one will ever know whether a fan gave it a kick, gave it a smack. That's another part of drama that people really don't remember from that tournament. May continue to play well, although he gets a little tired and starts to hook the ball off the tee in the three-hole playoff. He was also surprised. This was a new format. He was expecting to not to play three holes. Well, here you go. You put it all back together mentally, and they both sprayed the ball in the playoff. That just added to the drama.
So May didn't know that the playoff was going to be. He had no idea it was an aggregate score.
He said it's a three-hole playoff. This is a new format. Oh, 3 holes. Oh, that's going to be interesting. And so then you suck it up and get back out there. And Tiger, after they both made their putts at 18 in regulation, Tiger gave him a look and said, "Great playing." It was a real appreciation for what May had done right in the middle of it. And that's one of the great things about athletes. I think it's remarkable when they're so in the moment. You're so focused, you can barely tell what's going on around you. But you come out of that for a second just to realize the remarkable thing that you're part of.
And I think and you're right that most I think most people watching that probably then just assumed it was an inevitability that Tiger was going to win. It didn't matter when it was going to happen, but it was going to happen. But Bob May was so stubborn. I mean, first playoff hole, you have Tiger walk the ball in with the point after God knows what happened off the tee, and then I think people just kind of assumed, okay, here we go. He's going to win. There's no drama to it, but there still was. And I think if it were someone else, it might have been thought about a little differently. No offense to Bob May, incredible player, but I feel like people just thought, oh, well, he's just going to beat that guy.
True. One thing that I think May proved was the rest of us aren't just schlubs out here. Everybody on the, you don't get to the PGA Tour by accident. Everybody at his best can play magnificently. And some of the irons he hit on Sunday were as astounding. I mean, they made Tiger give him a huge smile and laugh at how brilliant a shot that May had hit just after Tiger's, again and again. It's almost May is going to have to tap out. Tiger has just hit a magnificent shot, and he is, after all, Tiger Woods. May stepped up and at least matched him again and again and again, for one of the most dramatic down the stretch back nines in a major that we've seen in a long time.
I think one of the underappreciated things about Bob May is that he sets up the groundwork in a weird way for all of Tiger's most interesting major challengers turn out to be complete unknowns or relative unknowns to the golf world. Between Bob May, Chris DeMarco, Rocco Mediate,
Yes.
even Angel Cabrera, I mean, he winds up winning two majors, but at Oakmont, first true runner-up in a major. That to have those things happen with those players as opposed to Ernie, Phil, I mean, you get Duval's run, but that's really it. I mean, those guys were the ones that stood up to Tiger the best.
Yes, and as terrific as many of Jack Nicklaus's competitors were, the tour is a good deal deeper by the time
Yes.
Tiger is winning his majors, as people like Mediate and DeMarco and May showed that that these players can all take you down, and to avoid that against such depth of competition is yet another underappreciated thing about the Tiger Slam.
Yeah, and I think the prior generation of golf fan saw Nicklaus. He had consistent foils for the most. I mean, not always, but he had a lot of consistent foils.
Right.
And I think that the assumption was that if Tiger doesn't have a foil, a singular foil, or a consistent battery of them, that somehow what is accomplished was less than what Jack accomplished because he didn't have the same people pushing him to the brink. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that is fair. And one thing that we tend to forget is that if there had been no Tiger, we'd probably be talking about the greatness of Phil Mickelson and Ernie Els.
Yeah.
And all of the 20 majors they won between them.
Yeah.
And Duval was a good foil in his way, and Phil certainly, especially personality-wise, was the ideal counterpoint to Tiger. But they, at this, especially at this point, they hadn't yet shown that they could step up and beat him when it counted.
And ultimately, between them, they get darn close to double digits majors. Between I mean, Els starts before Tiger gets going as a professional, but between them, they still accomplished a lot in the end.
They did have terrific careers, and imagine how many, if Tiger doesn't win his, how many those two might have won.
But then we spin it forward now, and I feel like in this new generation, between Scheffler and DeChambeau, and Brooks, I guess, is a bridge to a generation in a way, but he's the breadwinner of that generation with five, and Rory with four. It felt like for a time there was this, and maybe this happens in every generation of golf, a wondering of who are the main characters of that generation. And I think we've more or less established them now. Throw in Xander that with this year. But it felt like there are more of them now than there were in Tiger's generation, who had, even fewer than Jack probably had. So it just feels like the generational appreciation of Tiger maybe will improve over time because
Well, it
there are more
should,
capable
yes.
winners now.
Right, and he's responsible for some of the brilliance of the players that we see today. When he sets the bar higher than it had ever been higher before, well, that gives them something to shoot for. It would sure be fascinating to see him in his prime play against Scheffler and Shoffley and Bryson. He called Bryson beefy at one point when DeChambeau, of course, was bulking up. I think one of the things about Tiger's game at that time was that he kept a lot of power in reserve. Daly is usually winning the long drive title, but that's because Tiger was swinging at 95% most of the time. He steps up and shows Phil, who was boss on Sunday at the Masters on 13, hitting a 3-wood beyond the drive that Phil just busted. I think what he did gives today's players something to shoot for. Whether they win 15 majors, whether they win 18 majors, whether they ever win four in a row, I think each time when they're playing at Augusta, especially, they got to be thinking of him.
Right, and that he and we didn't even get to the part where he actually completes the slam part, right? And It almost, I mean, at least my sense from when I was high school or at the time, that there was almost a true inevitability. Okay, he's done three of them. Surely he's going to finish this off. With I feel like that was the sense of the time, and I think looking back on it, the betting markets had him something like 2.5 to 1 or 3 to 1 to win the Masters of all things.
Yes, partly because he had struggled. There was talk of a slump,
Yeah.
and reporters were asking, "Oh, well, what about your slump?" and making him very angry about that. And then he finally, of course, wins, just strides right past Jimmy Roberts and says, "How about that slump?" He did look mortal early in 2001,
Yes.
so I think that probably helped the people who bet on him get a little bit better odds. All the talk about whether this is a slam or not, I think certainly gave him additional motivation. He's not going to leave that question on the table. He's going to assert his right to what he considered a slam. And what, in the moment, I think to his great credit, Jim Nance answered the question in a very subtle, interesting way by saying, "It's as grand as it gets." And I think he was right about that.
And I think something that should be added is something that factors into whether you consider this a slam or not. But the importance of it is that he had to go 9 months with this question. Can you do this? Can you achieve this? You have an off season, you have time away. In a single Grand Slam year that now operates from April through July, you could have a 4 month whirlwind and maybe all of that kind of lines up right. But to do it in 3 consecutive months in the summer and then have to wait 9 more to answer the rest of the question, I think is striking.
Yes, with the constant questions, there was, other than maybe Jack Nicholson, there was no bigger Lakers fan than Tiger Woods. And he stopped watching SportsCenter before that Masters because he was so tired of them. Before you know it, they're going to cut away and say, "Oh, Tiger Woods is, if he wins, it's not really a, or there's debate." And he was tired of the hype. I've been asked about other sports feats. I do believe this is the best sports feat ever, actually. But in terms of dominance in modern, in the last, say, 50 years, I don't think any elite athlete dominated his competitors the way that Secretariat did, winning
Yeah.
by an enormous, the Triple Crown races, the last one, by such an enormous margin,
The
kind
Belmont
of like
photo.
Tiger did. Yes, but the thing is, Secretariat didn't have to sit through press conferences again and again and again and be asked, "How's your thinking? Are you worried about?" And Tiger did. He didn't enjoy the press conferences, but he would occasionally get off. Some question would intrigue him, and he would say something that was straight from the heart that I admired. To go through all that hype, I think, is a great part of what made that Masters a difficult challenge for him. Of course, it also helped him that he's got the entire off season to prepare for Augusta, and that's what he did every winter. It's useful for him to be on the range at Isleworth, hitting balls and having Steve Williams say, "Okay, this is the tee ball at 1 at Augusta. This is 13." He was ready to go by the time Thursday came along.
Yeah, if anyone were properly suited for a 9 month wait to answer a question, it goes
Yes.
back to the grinder's mentality, right? You can invent games to keep yourself engaged even when there's nothing to play for at that moment.
Yes, and the greats would do that. Michael Jordan used to, if he didn't have the particular motivation, he'd invent a grudge. Someone would say something that sounded, "Oh, that could almost be taken as somewhat critical of Michael." Well, that's what drives him. And the true greats, I think, are always looking for whatever. Brady was the same way. What is that last little bit that can drive me even further toward my utter potential?
Did Tiger have any sense of self-doubt in those nine? But we'll take the whole period of time, but especially in that intervening period between the PGA and the Masters, that maybe I can only do three.
He was always realistic enough to know there were a lot of other good players out there.
Yeah.
I think he still felt that it belonged to him. This, especially at this time of his career, the universe only made sense if Tiger Woods won. It's that way to him. The spheres are in place. Everything is right because I'm meant to make this putt. I'm meant to win. I've given all I've got inside to prepare myself for it, and that's what it takes. He believed that's what it took. He was also anticipating the back nine on Sunday at Augusta and knowing that that moment is made for him.
Do you get the sense that he appreciates his accomplishment even more now, almost 25, we're getting close to 25 years removed from it? Or is has he ever really, grieving's the wrong word, but properly celebrated it?
I don't know how he thinks about it today. He has talked some with seeing his son Charlie play and being a mentor and a swing coach himself. He said a very funny thing, anticipating the year 2025, which we're what 3 weeks away from, that he. And this is back when he was 25. He said he hoped to keep playing another 25 years so he could ride a cart and put his feet up on a senior tour one day. He's actually going to qualify for it a year from this month, and that will be fun to see. There's no doubt that he appreciated it at the time, which I think is a great thing. When he said, I'm planning to put them up on my coffee table. And then he went and did that and got to take a look at them. He knew how much that meant in golf history, even in that moment, I think.
What for you in researching, writing? The whole process of creating this book, what were you most impressed by? And maybe what was something that you learned or rediscovered in this process that you didn't remember or kind of took you back a little bit?
I was so taken by the approach he took to remaking his swing before the Tiger Slam, to dedicating himself to that at great risk. And Butch Harmon had told him, okay, we're talking about these things. You're going to really overhaul your swing. That's going to take a year or so. Tiger said, but I want to do it all at once. It does wind up taking a year and a half, is how gigantic a task it was. And Butch Harmon took the risk of being known as the guy who ruined Tiger Woods' career. I think the brilliance of that and the determination of that, the work ethic involved in that swing overhaul, and then putting the last piece of the puzzle together by using a new ball that suddenly performs, just to your specifications, and taking that out when he was the only one who had it. I think that really completed the puzzle and made it such a terrific narrative to work on for a couple of years.
Well, Kevin, thank you for spending so much time with me. I appreciate it. We could. There's so much to the Tiger Slam. I think that you just got to read the book to do it justice. I'm glad that you wrote it. It was a cool look back for me, 25 years removed, but 25 years later in life to appreciate. I think even more than when I saw it in real time. So, thank you for doing it. Thank you for the interview. Again, everyone, the book is The Tiger Slam. It's by Kevin Cook. Check it out where you get your books. Whether that's Amazon or elsewhere. And thank you again, Kevin. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ryan. It's good talking with you.
It's 10:01 a.m. on a Monday, all at once. Your sales leader needs to know which deals are at risk. Your PM wants feature adoption by cohort, and your CFO needs one last graph for the board. Now your data team has to say no to somebody. Hex changes that. Ask any data question in plain English and get an analyst-grade response, all backed by your actual business context as defined by your data team. Start saying yes to more data questions at hex.ai.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Are you a questioner, a wanderer, or even a bit of a snooper? If so, then you'll feel right at home in Knoxville. We've got miles of trails to wander in our urban wilderness. Award-winning eateries to satisfy your culinary cravings, cultural sites to open your mind, and dog-friendly activities that'll have everyone wagging. Knoxville, calling the curious. Learn more at visitknoxville.com.